Thanks very much, Paul. This microphone on? Can you hear it?
Yes.
Cool, great. Okay, so I wanted to, as Paul mentioned, talk about data, but I want to go into more of the semantics of data or the meaning of data, and then look at the implications for the semantic, particularly in this global world that we live in today. So I'm going to talk briefly about data. Everyone pretty much knows what that is. I'm going to talk, again, briefly about open data, but then I'm going to focus on linked open data because I see that's going to be the real crux to solving some issues that I suppose we gloss over today. So, for example, today when we talk about smart cities, every document you read from any city that says we're going to become a smart city, the document will say, use open data. And that's the solution to becoming smart. You just use open data. So I don't think they understand the implications of what it means to say use open data. And really, this smartness here, the smart word, actually comes from the link part of open data, not just open data itself. So there's a lot to go on, a lot of relationships there. So that linked open data is going to really focus us on semantics, the meaning. And we're not talking about smart cities. Cities don't exist by themselves in isolation. We're part of the world. So when we start talking about meanings for smart cities, it's going to have to, by default, be global. We have to incorporate semantics from around the world to understand the meaning of things in our smart city. And what that all means is that, which I'll get to at the end, is my sort of summary, is that we basically need to spend more time on the data architecture behind a smart city. So this is a use case or the objective, and the technology is over here. And we'll briefly look at the technology as well. So this was an article in The Economist recently, and basically saying that the world's most valuable resource is no longer oil, but data. Which is true. I mean, these big companies down here are fighting for data, and they see the value in data. The difference here is that data is complex. Oil is simple. It's a black, gooey thing, and you refine it, and you produce petrol or whatever, and you can sell it. You can monetize it. But with data, it's much more complex than oil. So to get the value out of data that they get that the same as people got value out of oil, you actually have to do a lot more work, a lot more varied work. You can't just build a refinery, throw your data in, and then get money at the other end. That doesn't work that way. So for data, we generate lots of data. We all know that. There's lots of data. But we don't really know what to do with it at the end of the day. I don't think we really know what to do apart from collect it. We know how to collect data. Everyone's probably devices now collecting data as you talk. And really, what we hope that analytics will give us some edge. You know, we hope and pray that some machine learning algorithm, a bit of AI here, is going to solve the problem of why did we get all this data in the first place? Where's the insights coming from? So that's one approach, is to look at data from a very algorithmic, analytic point of view. Open data is sort of takes a different approach. So open data says, well, okay, we've got data. I suppose it's much more focused data. It's more structured data. We'll get into some structure and semantics in a moment. And the idea is that if this doesn't give us an edge, what else can we do? What else in terms of giving the data to someone else, can they make more insights out of it? And that's really why a lot of government departments make their data open, because they collect it, they do something with it, but then they say, well, let the public do something else with it. It's there, so why do we hide it? So let's make it open data. So really, open data then has a number of advantages and goals. First of all, it creates opportunity. So it allows you to innovate and also provides economic growth. And there's lots of reports about governments in certain countries, if they open up their data, particular governments, what the economic benefit will be. That is, letting industry make some money out of the data that you've spent money collecting. And, of course, innovation, you know, come up with brighter ideas. You know, sometimes agencies aren't the best hot pot for new ideas, but give it to industry. They can write an app and then provide a better service. It improves government. So opening a data improves services. And one of the more interesting outcomes of that is this transparency. It improves transparency in government as well. The fact that you have to publish your data does improve transparency. Empowers citizens. So citizens now have access to data. They can make better decisions. And as well, social, at least the social mobilisation. When you know that something needs to change, you can make a decision based on data, and you can mobilise change as well. So you're empowering citizens through the openness of data. And of course, it solves public problems. So it's a data-driven solving. So it's not just trying in vain to hope that this will be solved. We've got data. We can engage with the data, we can assess the data, we can make decisions about the data. So open data really provides a lot of opportunities, improvements, empowerment, and a lot of solving of public problems, big problems in particular. As an example, this report, The Global Impact of Open Data, released I think earlier this year, goes through and lists about 20 different projects around the world of open data. And this one caught my eye. It's the open data in Mexico. And they opened the data for primary schools, to try and get them to have higher quality education. So the government opened up all their data. And what they found was that the data was uncovered a widespread corruption in the Mexican education system and stirred a national outrage. So socially mobilised the people because there was open data. And that wouldn't have happened if they didn't make that data openly available. Now, this is an edge case, but it's a very important edge case. This doesn't happen every time there's open data being published. If it did, we'll be in trouble. But this does show the power of data being assessed correctly and in the right hands. So open data, as I mentioned, drives smart cities. So a smart city physically has sensors, it's got devices, all in buildings, in moving vehicles, and they communicate and they share data. And the idea is that together they can provide better improved services and then make the city smart. So in Hong Kong, a couple of examples of reports from the Hong Kong Smart City, or Digital City, depending on how you want to refer to it. This report released a few months ago, from Nielsen's and Google in Hong Kong. They talk about a smarter digital city for Hong Kong. And I just took out this particular section here where they talk about policymakers should encourage the use of open data as one of its key. In fact, I think that's probably should be much more strongly worded than that, than just encouraged. It should be mandated that they use open data, because without that, you're not going to get a smart digital Hong Kong city. There was another report from PwC, again, on a smart city blueprint for Hong Kong in June this year. It's a much longer report, a lot more in-depth. If you're interested to get that report, it's online. And in that report, they talk about different principles. Data should be open as much as practical, timely, comprehensive, etc. And in particular, this point here, the number 4, was the one I want to highlight, because it's really related to the semantics and the understanding, is that data must be comparable and interoperable. So interoperable means you're following standards. Comparable means that you can actually take data from one device or one other service and actually compare it and understand that they can be compared and understand what it means when you do some sort of assessment on that data. So that's an important, I think, part of that's really where linked data comes in. because open data is usually a silo. It's still coming from one department or one agency or one industry, whereas linked open data is saying, well, you know, we've got all this various data coming from different sources. How do you actually compare them? How can we make sure that we have the same semantics across all the different data sets? So that point four actually is referred to from another report, which is from opendatacharter.net, which goes into that principle four in a lot more detail. But what does it mean to have comparable and interoperable data? And there's all these statements here about what it means. So, and it's quite, you know, it actually tries to be a charter. So it says, as a city, we will implement consistent open standards, ensure open data sets, et cetera, ensure the data is fully described, engage with standards bodies and other standards setting initiatives, map local standards and identify to emerging globally agreed standards, et cetera. So it sets up a charter, if you like, of what your city will provide to the community in order to get them to meet that one particular principle there. So that really leads us to the requirement that a smart city needs a data architecture. You can't build something without architecture. If you did, you'd be living dangerously, literally. Buildings will fall down and you'll put people's lives at risk. That's why architecture in the building industry is so important. And architecture, blueprints, they really convey shared meaning across different stakeholders who are building things that people to live in. This is Barcelona. And it's, as you can see, just by looking at it, you can sort of see there is an architecture there. They actually designed the city. All the roads are running parallel. You notice all these blocks have sort of angled corners on them all. They all look very similar. So an architecture has been applied to the city, physically, physical architecture to the whole city. So we need to take the same principles of this example here in Barcelona and take and say use data as an architecture for a smart city as well. The same concepts needs to apply. As an example, in London or in the UK or more Britain, I suppose in general, Britain is one of the leading sort of governments behind open data. They've got a lot of resources behind open data, and it's a centre of their transition into a smart city. And a number of other reports that they've been released to people who worked for them in that space. They're quotes such as, at the end of the day, it all comes down to the data. Because without the data, you're not going to have a smart city. In this case here, they talk about building an ecosystem and they talk about a platform for the city, a platform for the city to enable it to share its open data. And also to not only just look at the public sector, but to make sure the private sector as well as citizens all participate in that shared platform. So this then takes us on to the topic of the linked open data. So how do you deal with data that you've never seen before? That's the crux to this. A lot of open data, you have to know the data. You've got to understand the fields or the attributes or the elements in the data to do anything. But what if you don't know them? How do you deal with them? How can we, at a very interoperable way, make sure we understand them? The answer to that is the semantic web. So what is the semantic web? I won't go into the technical details, but I'll just mention a few of the highlights. So the semantic web is a group of technologies built by the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium, which is the director is Tim Berners-Lee. And it's really a formal knowledge representation mechanism, a modelling technique. So without trying to scare people away when you start saying formal knowledge representation, it's actually very simple underneath the actual model that they use. And the semantic web, though, has a few requirements that you have to abide by, with, otherwise we won't get linked open data. The first one is this one of global identification. What that means is if I want to describe something, I want to describe which I'll get into a good example of it in a moment. If I want to describe something, I need to know how to refer to it. if I want to talk about this chair here, I need some identifier for it, right? It could be a local identifier, like it's row, no, it's row one, chair number four in building five or whatever. But globally, remember we're talking globally now, how can I refer to that particular asset globally? I need some identifier for it. The other thing is that the semantics in the semantic web come from properties. That is how you describe things, the attributes of a class. In other in modeling techniques like UML, a lot of the semantics, or the first class semantics, is at the class level, not the inside attribute level. And the real crux of the semantic web is this automatic reasoning and inferencing, which you get because you have this formal knowledge representation. So in the semantic web, I can actually reason and infer new rules automatically. And the final part of the semantic web is the open world assumption, which maps into the global world we live in. It means that anything that you don't know, you cannot say you can't say it's not true. So the open world assumption means that I've got some data. I can't make any assumptions that someone else has data that disputes my data. Someone could actually negate what I've said. So the open world assumption means you need to be aware that the world could be saying stuff about your asset, your digital asset, that you don't understand or aware of. But it's still valid assumptions about what you have in your data assets. So linked open data has what they call maturity levels. And they even produce a cup which you can buy. So with the five different levels. Linked open data is on the web, is one star. It's machine readable, which means it's at least in some sort of proprietary format like even Excel or PDF. Level three is non-proprietary, so it could be CSV files. Then level four and five is when we get to RDF standards, and then linked RDF is the final level five. And that's really where you want to end up, because at the moment most open data is sitting there and the probably at the non-proprietary format level. At least it's machine readable and it's on the web. So most sites that you go to now will have CSV files, maybe some JSON files, a lot of Excel files still, just in native Excel. But really where we want to end up is down here, the target state, which we really want to be able to get our data to be semantically aware, because that's really how we're going to build our smart city. So RDF, which is the Resource Description Framework, which is one of the technologies in the semantic web. There's two or three or maybe four main ones. RDF is the crux of it all. And in RDF, everything is a resource. And they use the phrase, things, not strings. So a string is interesting in data because it's text, and you can do things with text. You can sort of try and parse it. But humans are also really bad at text because we write text in completely different ways. We use different characters, we didn't put funny spaces in, we use uppercase, lowercase. And machines hate text in the semantic web. They'd rather have something they can identify that is a thing than trying to parse text and try and work out the semantics for it. And RDF is really good at combining data from disparate sources. So open data from different sites, linking them together, combining them, trying to assert new axioms or rules is really what RDF tries to solve. And it also allows you to discover more data. So it allows you to say, oh, I have this data, tell me more data, tell me more about this thing. Let me go off and find more about this particular resource or this particular thing. And you can also learn the schema or ontology. And you can actually tell it, well, I've got this new property, which you've never seen before, but here is how I'm going to tell you about it, so that you can now understand this new property. So the machine can now learn a new property, which can then be used to describe some smart device in your smart city. And your data is more discoverable as well. It makes sure that it enables you to make your data more available to more people, because it enables you to link it great in more ways. So there's lots of open data repositories. There's a few listed there. There's a big site that tries to list the majority of all the open data repositories. And the key thing about those is that they're actually all linked. So all of those little repositories of data are all linked together in some way. And typically one of the most key ones we use in semantics is DBpedia. And you can sort of see all these other data sets are all linked to DBpedia. DBpedia is basically Wikipedia. It's the RDF version of Wikipedia. So all the Wikipedia data, which is for human consumption, has been translated into machine representation. So it's used a lot to give a foundation for semantics. So if you want to describe something, if you want to reuse something in your own data, then you go to DBpedia first. There are others, but that's one of the main ones. So this linking of all these repositories gives us this global web of data. So no longer is it just a global web of HTML files for humans to read, but it's a global web of data as well. And the repositories allow us to reuse concepts, terms, types, properties, etc. And that reuse really means that we're now participating in a global semantic world, because I'm using someone else's semantics to describe my data because I'm reusing it. You can do some really nice things like assert sameness, which is quite powerful, particularly in the open web, in that I can say that that chair is the same as that chair. The same identifiers are used. As well as that, there's also the ability to provide provenance data about the repository itself, so you know how often it's updated, who owns it, and make sure you can make decisions based on that. So let's look at an example, probably to sort of bring it to greater understanding. So let's look at the case study of data.gov.hk. Now, I've given this talk in Australia, and I give the same outcome if I replace these few slides with the data in Australia, in Brisbane, in Queensland. I could probably do it even in London, in pretty much any city. So this is not unique to Hong Kong, but I just use Hong Kong as an example because we're all standing here in this beautiful city. So, electric car charging stations. Why not? You've got an electric car. You want to be a great citizen. You want to be a smart citizen. You've got a smart car. It's an electric car. But you need to charge it. So where do you go to charge it? You want to go to, potentially, if you're driving around, you want to go to a car park that's got an electric vehicle charging station in it in some form. So on data.gov.hk, I can go there, search electric vehicle charging station. I get this data set here. It's a XML file. And there's also a little PDF document down here which gives a look like a little data dictionary. And there's another one as well. There's two. So there's two data sets for charging stations in car parks. And again, this one's in CSV format. And again, there's a little PDF of the data dictionary for the two data sets. So I've got two data sets. So this is quite a simple example, but you can imagine this magnified across all the data, not only in Hong Kong, but everywhere. So here are two data sets. We look at the data dictionaries for both. One's quite small, this one over here. It's just got things like the field name, it's a string, where it is, the address, the level floor, the parking bay number, and then the service providers. This is the key part, which is what type of charging is it? Standard, quick charge, quick charging, this whatever, Chimino format or IEC Type 2 format, some very technical things there. But that's stuff that's important for my smart car, because my car knows what charge it needs, doesn't it? So I need to be able to understand this data here. And there's a long lat as well. In the other XML one, this is only a half of it. It's similar data. There's a lot more fields. There's a long lat. There's a type, which has got standard, semi-quick, and quick. So standard, quick charging. And HIS has got standard, semi-quick, and quick. So immediately you can sort of see a semantic disconnect there. And then there's a location, etc. So there's some similar properties and some dissimilar ones. So here's the data. The first data in the CSV file, and this is all the data in that first data set. So you can sort of see where the location is, and then you can see the service providers. This is really what the crux of the data is. This is how I'm going to plug my car in, and there's a long lat. And Another one, well, let's look at the cyber car park down here, Cyberport car park. Let's focus on this one here, because I've just taken the XML, the other data set. So that's the data set for the XML. For Cyberport, I'm assuming it's the same station. It's almost got the same long lat, a couple of decimal points out. It's got the location, etc. So here are two data sets. They've got different attributes or different properties. They're in different formats. So the questions I need to ask myself now, right, is why are these two stations completely different? Why do they have the different attributes about them? How can I identify it's the same station? How do I really know that those two Cyberport stations, parking stations, were actually the same ones? How can I tell that type, the property type in one, and service provided in the other one are actually the same properties? And in terms of the values, how can I tell that the word standard, the string standard, is actually the same as this string here? The answer is very difficult, right? Because these are all, particularly that last point is about these are all string-based queries. So it's very hard to do that. But of course, so what we want to be able to do is actually have more identifiable semantics. So when we go to DBpedia, for example, dbpedia.org, DBpedia, as I said, basically has millions of resources and about things. And lo and behold, you find the description of a parking lot and a parking space. And not only that, here's a parking lot and here are all the properties about it. I won't go into details of the properties, but these are properties about a parking lot, properties about a parking space. But this is the key thing here. This URI. This URI here identifies this semantic. This URI here identifies this semantic. So if I'm a data semantic data processing system, I see this URI here, I immediately know that what you're talking about is a parking space. Because that's how the DBpedia works. This is all encoded in RDF in the background, but that's really the crux of it all. And not only that, I've got all these different different syntaxes, depending on where I feel like. I can still get JSON out, I can get XML, but it's encoded in the RDF model. And so I can actually query it as a machine processor and say, give me the RDF JSON for the parking lot. Then, of course, in our use case, we're interested in charging stations because we want to go to a car park that's got a charging station in one of the car parking lots because I want to plug my smart car into it. So, again, in DBpedia, they had the concept of a charging station and there are properties about it. And the really interesting here is that there's this thing called same as. Remember I mentioned sameness? I can also assert that this object in DBpedia is the same as this Wikidata charging station. So I'm building up linkages between different semantic definitions across the global web. So that's the charging station. And then guess what? I also got in Wikipedia SAE J1772, which is a particular type of connector for electric cars. I've got this funny CHAdeMO one as well, all defined semantically with URIs. So instead of putting that funny long string in my data, I put the URI for this or the URI for that. And then the machine knows exactly what I'm talking about. It knows exactly, not only that, my car knows what I'm talking about. My smart car that uses this standard here knows, don't go find me a car park that only uses this standard because I won't be able to plug it in. So those sort of simple decisions can be made in a smart environment. So that's DBpedia. That's only one. It's probably the most famous one. There's also other ones like Wikidata. I mentioned Wikidata, and I mentioned this is the charging station in the previous slide defined it as being same as this charging station. They actually use Q numbers, so their URL is a bit funny. They actually don't use words. They actually use Q something or other, but that's machines don't care about that. This was interesting in that it's a bit like DBpedia, but it's open to the world to add data to it. So here is a charging station. I've got some properties down here about it that goes on and on. Here is some stuff about it and just sort of labels, English and Chinese. And what it does, it provides you with a button called add statement. I can click on that. Anyone can click on that and add properties about a charging station. So whatever properties, you know, if I work for an electric company, I say, well, here are all the properties for a charging station. I can add that to it. And what I did the other night is you notice here that the charging station has a Cantonese label here. This is not defined, no description, and also known as. I just simply added a little also known as electric vehicle charging station. That's what they seem to be called in the gov.hk website. But you, for example, right now, you could go to this page, click on edit, and you could type in the Cantonese name of a electric charging station. It's trying to get the people to actually add semantics to them. So very briefly then, I won't go into this in detail, but you know, underlying all this, of course, is a model. Without a data model, we really can't get and extract semantics out. Most open data is typically flat. It's here is a thing and here is a whole long list of attributes about it. There's no attempt to provide any data model. Here is a very, I just made this data model up, but it's hopefully pretty close. You have a parking lot which has a location, has an address, contains a parking space which has a location which could be on level 5, base 12, whatever. And all these blue items here are semantics from DBpedia. Then, of course, here in Hong Kong, you say, well, actually, my parking space, I want to now indicate whether it has a feature. So I've got a property called has feature, which is an electric charge point, whatever you want to call it. We could link that to the Wikidata one. So I can add that in Hong Kong semantics. That's why it's in orange. But what I need to do is quite simply state that this thing here I defined in my Hong Kong open data is actually of type charging station from DBpedia. That means that all other applications that have smart apps that deal with finding electric charging points, they understand this semantic. They then know, by default, that's the same thing. They then know how to process this because it is of the same type. So the machine's doing this. No humans there's no human involved. All I'm doing is doing the link. I'm making the link from this to here. And then just keep continuing that. In my case, for example, in our case in Hong Kong, we say, well, it supports what we call semi-quick and quick charge. That's how we want to call them, for example. But what we will then do is link them to DBpedia and say, well, they're actually the same as CHAdeMO or whatever, and that's the same as IEC Type 2. So an application then knows that, particularly a smart car that was built overseas, that may only understand, but may require this type of connection, it will see this, and the smart app will say, okay, that's the same as this. So I'm asserting the sameness again. So that sameness is actually quite a powerful feature of the semantic web. So now I know where the electric car stations are, right? The electric charging points are. I now know where they are. The next question is it free? Is that spot actually free? Otherwise, I'm going to risk driving there. So here's all the gov.hk open data for real-time parking vacancies. There's at least 12 of them. And guess what? They're all different. So guess how? What I'm going to have to do as a programmer. I'm going to have to write a lot of code that doesn't understand. So the same problem again. We need to look at all this here and then try and work out how to have a common model. So really the reality is a smart car, you drive a smart car in a smart city, right? I need a smart parking lot. I need the parking lot to be smart. It needs to have smart parking bays with real-time availability data, with a smart booking feature, so I can see, yep, that parking bay that I need for my charge is free. I want to book it right now. And I also need smart traffic data, because it could take me, I don't know how long it's going to take me to get there as well. So all these stuff build onto each other. So I've given you a very small example of just simply how to find an electric charge outlet in a parking lot. So imagine starting to scale this up. And this is just one part of a smart city, which is just a smart car trying to find a parking bay, right? So the crux of it is that you really can't build a smart city with dumb data. It's quite as blunt as that. So we need to have a semantic data architecture. So that really means we have to spend a lot more time in the architecture phase to enable the smart city to be built. So by spending more time in the architecture phase, we can actually build a smart city that's going to scale and it's going to operate in the way that all the stakeholders expect to occur. So really, there's some strategy, first of all, needed to sort of to be applied to a smart city. Because as I mentioned at the beginning, simply stating that my smart city will work because we use open data is frankly not going to cut it in the real world. It's not. It will fail. So as a city, if I'm representing a particular city, I need to have a lot more rigor than just simply relying on open data as it is today to drive my city's smartness. The first thing, of course, is also always to design the architecture as the data consumer. So you have to think about I'm in a car driving my little smart electric car around. What do I want to do? I want to drive. I want to find a parking lot that has a charge. Let's work through that. Let's use case that. And that's just one use case. There's thousands of other use cases. So when you build an architecture, you need to understand the consumer. So sometimes when you build a house or a building, you need to understand what their requirements are. If you don't have requirements, then you're going to build something that someone generally doesn't really want. Then we have to focus on those data models. Otherwise, we need to... the data models, we need to develop ones or preferably reuse others because there's lots of them out there. There's tons of ways to describe geospatial locations, addresses, people, buildings, cars. There's a lot of sites out there that provide that data for you. And there's a lot of standards bodies, if you go back to those set of promises before, that actually do that. They actually publish data about, for smart cars, here's the data you should use. So there's no need for a city to redevelop those. You just simply go there and take it and implement it. So there's a lot of data models out there. The other key, though, is to link it to and define the global semantics. So you can use your own semantics. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's encouraged to meet local requirements. But to link it to the defined global semantics, like what DBpedia does, that enables applications to scale. So that you can buy, so applications can work across cities. The other one really is about capability, because I'm sure some of you in this room, when I mentioned semantic web and RDF, your eyes probably rolled back and think, "Oh my God, what's he on about? Knowledge representation." You need to have some capability of the smart city designers, so both government and industry. They need to understand that these technologies require some additional capability in their abilities to deliver. And the final one really is the platform side of things, a smart city platform, as I mentioned before, what London is trying to build as well. Because the idea there is that we need to be able to provide more resources to help this capability to actually enable us to reuse common data models to help drive the delivery of these services to consumers. So the platform is not just a website like they are today, which is just populated with open data. And in fact, some of those, that screen I showed you before of all the real-time parking spaces, with 10 of them on there, there's a few more, 5 of them all were error 404 when you clicked on them. Which is not good. It's not good for a smart city if you've got error 404. So you need a platform that enables the data to survive across time. And that's probably one of the biggest issues with identification of data, is that, not sure what happens in Hong Kong, but in Australia, government agencies change every election. They change their names, they merge, they split up, and their name changes, their domain changes, and all their website changes, and all their data changes. For no reason about the fact that people want to have their own identity. And that means that identifying data assets in government is tough because changes in government, the machinery of government changes so often. So you need to take that away from government agencies that change and say, outside of the government, I want to identify some health data. I want to identify all the sporting locations in Hong Kong. Don't give it identities that are linked to the Department of Sports. Give it identities that are independent from the government agency that runs it. And that's what a platform can do. It can help you identify your assets so they are immune to changes to things like government. Okay, and I think that's the main ending point. So hopefully you've sort of got a better idea as to the scope of what a smart city needs to do, and hopefully some idea as to how open data, in particular linked open data, can actually help drive the path towards that smartness. Happy to answer any questions.